So today we're doing Ishvapanishad, text 2 and 3. So we have done the invocation and mantra number 1. And the introduction as well. Alright, so I'll read the mantras. Mantra 2. Kuravan evaha karmani jivisech chitam samaha evam tvayi nan yateto sti na karma lipite nare. One may aspire to live for hundreds of years if he continuously goes on working in that way. For that sort of work will not bind him to the law of karma. There is no alternative to this way for man. Mantra 3. Asurya nama te lokaha andena tamasabrita tams te pacha vigachanti yeke chatma hano janaha. The killer of the soul, whoever he may be, must enter into the planets known as the worlds of the faithless, full of darkness and ignorance. Okay, so the first mantra, of course, has described the conception of the Supreme Personality of Godhead being complete and making complete arrangements for all the living entities within the material worlds. And the second verse, or the first verse of the Ishvapanishad describes working in such a God-conscious relationship, always seeing everything in its relationship with the Supreme Lord from whom everything has emanated. And that conception, of course, is the Isavasya conception of life. Mantra 2 here, of course, describes the benefit of working in the Isavasya conception of life. One becomes free from the karmic reactions and acts on the liberated platform. Such activities, they're the only method for freedom. And in contrast, Mantra 2, of course, explains the fate of those who fail to recognize the Lord's proprietorship and therefore act in a vikarmic way or an unauthorized way or a way that causes bondage.
Can I just say something?
Yes.
When I read Mantra 2 and I read
You're saying you didn't quite pick up the flow, the connection between the previous mantras and this one.
No, this mantra and the third one are mismatched. I mean, like, even the word killer of the soul does not even appear. I mean, killer of the soul, according to the text, is Atmaha.
You're looking at mantra 3?
Okay, that one is getting me. But even with mantra 2,
you're saying the transliteration of the words? The way the words are translated word for word.
Yeah, and the third one, but he's just saying to me that you should ignore the third one.
No, just if you read just translation of the first one, then number 2
would
make sense.
That's what I'm saying, ignore the third one, just read the mantra, and then it makes sense. But if you read the mantra.
Well, let's try that, shall we?
The same thing happened to me, and I was so confused. And I was thinking something is wrong with the vision.
Okay, let's look at mantra one. Everything animate or inanimate that is within the universe is controlled and owned by the Lord. One should therefore... So now it's going into how one should act. How should one act? One should act in this way. One should therefore accept only those things necessary for himself, which are set aside as his quota, and one should not accept other things, knowing well to whom they belong. One may aspire to live for hundreds of years if he continuously goes on working in that way. For that sort of work will not bind him to the law of karma. There is no alternative to this way for man.
Yeah?
It does show the benefits, though, of reading in the Association of Devotees. It's very helpful.
Can I ask another question?
Yes.
What is the history?
History?
Yes.
Here it is there.
Conceptually, the writing of the book, not
Prabhupada? Prabhupada's writing Vishuddhanishad.
Yes.
First printing in 1972. But we've got down here, let me see. It looks like the first printing in 1972, 20,000 copies. Is that? No. 69, that's what I was looking at, 69 and 74. Is that? Does that mean the Bhaktivedanta Book Trust was copyrighted in that time, or this actual book? Where are you looking?
Before the content, just the page before the content.
Yeah.
I think this would be the... Because it says that the printing in 1996.
But aside from that, never mind the printing.
Yes.
Normally you talk about, we know that the mantra is contained in that devotional, all the divine conducted up in the right.
Yes.
And this one, the
Sri Isha Parisha. Yes.
What
does it mean? What do we say? The Rig Veda. We said that the other day. The
Yajur. So it is extraction from the Yajur, which represents the assembly and the essence.
Yeah. Yes, within the. That Veda, this conversation or list of instructions will be there literally with the title of the Isipanishad. Quite often, within the Veda, it will sort of lead into a particular topic, and it will give a name to the next series of verses, according to whether it's a Samhita or Upanishad or Aranyaka or what have you, give a name according to. Sometimes the particular content that it may be about, if it may be particular about, a particular incarnation of the Lord, or if it's spoken by someone, or the questions that the person's asking, the questions may be very famous. So here, of course, Isho means the first. Isho, is it? Is a Sanskrit scholar. The meaning of Isho?
Controller.
Controller. Okay. Isha, yes. I had a feeling that it was actually one of the first of the Upanishads. I'm not sure where I got that from.
Yeah.
Huh?
The name of Krishna?
Isha, yes, yeah.
I have heard in Vishnu,
the
thousand names of Vishnu.
Yeah.
Or not the name of Vishnu.
That's right. So, as a supreme controller, it does, you know, it is certainly presenting the Lord's proprietorship, his control over everything. For some reason, I also had a feeling it was one of the first that was also, but don't quote me on that.
Is that true? Is the first generation?
But
it is presented as the first.
Yes, yeah, that's what I thought.
It is.
Yeah, that was my understanding, but I'll have to look at that. I've always had that understanding. I think I've read it somewhere, but I'll have to look at that. To confirm it. You know, you get different Upanishads, and they have a particular name according to the content, or sometimes the speaker and the inquirer. Sometimes the Upanishads are named after them because they're particularly famous. So, just like in the Srimad Bhagavatam, you know, you have the songs of the gopis. What do they call that? The Brahmara. There's a Gopi Gita. There's the verses where Srimati Radharani talks to the bumblebee. Brahmara Gita or something. You know, so they a whole series of verses like this will be given a particular name by the speaker of that particular topic. Yeah. So they can. I mean, I've not read, you know, for instance, one of the Vedas from start to finish. I don't think I've even ever seen one. Has anyone ever seen one of the Vedas? You've seen one from start to finish, do you know?
I haven't read it. I have seen it.
You've seen, yeah. How they're actually ordered, you know, whether they, you know, the Upanishad is written in the last part of the Veda, or whether it's, you know, slotted in within other.
I have heard that it is towards the end.
Towards the end, yeah.
Not from devotees, from other people.
From others, yeah. So, because as we described, you've got the Samhita portion, which is usually prayers, you know, learned by the brahmacharis, the Brahma portion, which describes a lot of the actual practical rituals, then the Aranyaka, which describes retiring, and then the Upanishads, which describe the transcendental knowledge one should be meditating upon in the stage of complete renunciation. It makes sense that, you know, they would actually be somehow ordered predominantly in that way within the Veda. But I've not seen, you know, in other words, whether that cycle is sort of repeated, you know, that there may be the first, you know, whether there could be four sections of a Veda and that cycle is repeated four times, or whether it just, I'm not sure, because I've never read a whole Veda. I've even seen one. But is that what you're getting at, how it's sort of placed within the Vedas?
I just want to know context, like we know what's happening. The Srimad Bhagavatam is easy in communication. Several questions, asked by inquirer, and suddenly, you know, one context. Because there's a logic to why, you know, the translations flow, but if you read the book fragmentally and
The Srimad Bhagavatam is not that easy to follow as well, in one sense. You know, when you actually try to work out, you know, when it was spoken, you know, because you've got the Srimad Bhagavatam, as we know, which was spoken by Srila Vyasadeva, or, you know, compiled by him. And then you've got Sukadeva Goswami speaking it. So, and there are a lot of verses in the Srimad Bhagavatam which Sukadeva Goswami spoke. So did Vyasadeva write them? And then you've got Sudha Goswami describing many of his own verses. So did Sukha speak them, and did Vyasadeva write them? It's not as simple as what it actually seems. But the strange thing is that the Srimad Bhagavatam has a definite amount of verses, which is, I think, is 18,000. Those 18,000, there's a particular way that they're counted. They're not, you know, in other words, if you just go through each chapter and count up all the verses, you won't come to that figure, because some verses are longer, which will be counted as two, and some are half, and like that. So there's a particular meter, a certain amount of syllables in each verse. So, but when you do it properly and you work out, it comes to about 18,000, maybe a couple over, what have you. And that includes, you know, all of Sudha Goswami's and Sukadeva Goswami's. And that is mentioned, you know, in very ancient references, that the Srimad Bhagavatam is famous for, you know, having these particular subjects and having 18,000 verses. So, you know, the understanding was, way, way, way in the past, that would include Sudha Goswami's verses and Sukadeva Goswami's verses and Vyasadeva's verses. Scriptures have a transcendental origin, and they're eternal. And at certain stages, those eternal scriptures become manifest. So it appears to have a historical, you know, beginning. But if you actually just try to trace it literally to just a historical point in time, you'll have a lot of difficulty, you know, doing that. But so it's, you know, Srimad Bhagavatam is even the Mahabharata, as we described, you know, there's different times where it's actually appeared in different forms. So the Upanishad, it is within the, as we said, the Yajurveda, was it? And it describes the how to work in God consciousness in order to become completely free from the cycle of karma. So if you deal with the Samhita and the Brahma portion, as we said, for the Brahmacharis, the Grihasthas, generally those two portions of the Veda are considered the Karmakanda portion. You know, we quite often hear of Karmakanda. So those first couple are considered the Karmakanda portion. So the Vedas can, you know, a Veda can also be divided into Karmakanda, Upasana Kanda, and Jnana Kanda. You know, the rituals for how to act in this world to get a particular result, that's karma. You know, as described in this purport, there are activities which produce karma, but produce good karma. You get a result in the material world, either on this planet or going to them. Generally, that is the karma kanda portion, which is described there in the Samhita and the Upanishad portions. Then you have the Upasana kanda, which describes worship of the demigods and also worship of the Supreme Lord. So it is worship. Especially, you know, worship of the demigods, generally people may want to, you know, attain heavenly planets or what have you. Get particular results within this world, but ultimately that they are being led within that process of worship to actually worship the Supreme Lord, who is actually you know, allowing the demigods to give whatever results they're giving. And then the Jnana Kanda portion teaches us to literally become detached from all those processes described and giving up the worship, which is worship of the demigods for material results. That worship should take a transcendental nature, that is being described here in the Upanishad. So really this is part of the Jnana Kanda section, and you'll see that in these verses it's helping us to make a shift, that is described there. There are three different types of activities. There are activities of karma, vikarma, and apkarma. These verses are actually recommending apkarma, which is the Jnana Kanda portion of the Vedas, that which is teaching you to rise above the cycle of birth and death. By coming to the point of transcendental knowledge, one becomes detached from activities in the material world, detached from trying to enjoy in the material world, and takes up akarma activities rather than karma activities. So that's that. These verses are teaching us akarma. Recommending that we certainly don't take up vikarma, which is forbidden activities or going against the principle of God consciousness. Prabhupada's purports fill in the gaps because people can't just come to the platform of akarma activities. You see that Prabhupada states that in his purport. Anywhere, anyone want to try and find that? Who's read that? I've got it. Page 13, second paragraph. Prabhupada says, actually no one has to do anything more than render devotional service to the Lord. So that's akarma activities. Activities which are purely in God consciousness, dedicated to the Lord. It's the second page of Mantra 2. If your books are different. Yeah. Factually, no one has to do anything more than render devotional service to the Lord. See that? He says, however, in the lower stages of life, one cannot immediately adopt the activities of devotional service, nor can one completely stop fruitive work. So then Srila Prabhupada... Oh, okay. It's the fourth paragraph in the purport to text 2. Got that? Factually, no one has... Yeah? So, although this mantra is actually teaching us apkarma, to work in such a way that there is no reaction to one's work. By working in God consciousness, Prabhupada is pointing out that factually people just cannot come to that platform. Therefore, so here, you know, Srila Prabhupada is actually filling in a lot of gaps for us. This is the beauty, of course, is that, for instance, had we been going through the Yajurveda, we would have read many instructions in the Samhita and the Brahmana portion, you know, how to perform karma activities to get particular results. Gradually, we would also have introduced, you know, worship of various demigods, or worship of the Supreme Lord according to our understanding of the nature of things. So we would have had, you know, about nearly 4,000 verses, and then we come to the Upanishads, if they're at the end, which are then describing to now that you've, you know, heard so much instruction on the karma sort of portion, now we want you to come to the akarma portion. So here Srila Prabhupada's filling in that gap. Otherwise it's a big jump, isn't it, you know, from...
Can I ask a question about this? I was discussing with somebody today about the currency, because one temple I know in Europe, they said there was not much attention paid to the time in which you break your currency fast. And this person was appalled, was saying that if you break it, if you don't adhere to that, you might as well not fast. Now, because the attitude of that temple was that, you know, it's a mantra, chanting, that is the key thing to learn one.
Where do those instructions lie?
What should we actually be doing? There's so much confusion.
Right. Yeah. We see that we in the Nectar Devotion, we actually did read that at the end of chapter 13, after describing all the different 64 different principles, such as following a codicil. And they are principles, and there are details which are in Sanatana Goswami's book, such as what you're describing there. So that sort of thing is not mentioned in Nectar Devotion. And actually, for many years, devotees had no real idea about, you know, when to break a codicil. That sort of came in a bit later. In the early days of the movement, it just... You know, didn't really hear about it too much, you know. If you had the Nectar Devotion, of course you wouldn't read about it, because it's just not in there. It's not in Bhagavad Gita from what I've seen. You know, it's information, they're details, you know, probably from the Hari Bhakti Vilas and what have you. So for many years in ISKCON, of course, many devotees didn't follow that. They just broke the codicil the next day. Some of them probably too early, some probably too late. Wasn't a particular problem, either in Prabhupada's time or after his time. So certainly, in that sense, Srila Prabhupada was... confident that the fact that you're following your codicil as far as possible, chanting, reading, extra meditating upon the Lord, that was the main thing. Now of course we have in ISKCON where we know that we should break at a certain time, if possible, if devotees understand that and it's not too difficult, they should try and do that. And it's not, you know, if there's a mood that once a rule has been, you know, revealed, that, oh, we never followed that in the past, it didn't cause us any problems, so, you know, it's not important to us now. That mood is not very pleasing to the Lord, because all the different rules and regulations are actually coming from the Lord himself. I was reading a verse last night. I can't remember exactly what I was reading. I think it was related to the commentaries by the Acharyas on that section of the Nectar Devotion, that a devotee who neglects these rules and regulations, the little details and what have you, they're considered to be a hater of the Lord. You know, in other sense, that they don't have love for the Lord, because there's not an understanding that, oh, Krishna likes it to be this way. Oh, Krishna likes it to be that way. Then, you know, certainly we'll do it. So there are. I remember now that verse was in relation to it. It was actually chapter 14 of the Nectar Devotion. I was going over it. You see there that Rupa Goswami describes that devotees don't have the rules of the Varnashram don't apply. They're not counted as limbs of bhakti, and therefore devotees will neglect a lot of the rules of Varnashram. Yeah, that's what I was reading. And there are verses, you know, in the Upanishads and what have you, which states that if you neglect any of the rules of the Lord, then you're a hater of the Lord. So that's where that verse came in. But then, Vishwanath Chakravarti, I think it was explaining that that applies to the people on the path of Karmakanda or within Varnashram. It doesn't apply to the people in bhakti, because they're actually executing a more pleasing activity for the Lord. Alright, so for instance, therefore then they're neglecting many, many different rules, but they're not considered to be offending the Lord or in any way a hater of the Lord. In fact, they're considered better lovers of the Lord, because they're neglecting rules and regulations so that they can follow another rule and regulation which is more pleasing activity to the Lord. To give an example, Govinda, he was Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's servant, and as we know, one should never try to enjoy the property of the Lord, as stated in this verse, nor the spiritual master. Govinda was seen lying on the Lord's bed. So, that's a definite, you know, if you get caught lying on the Lord's bed enjoying his property, it's not very good. So you can imagine, for instance, if the queen went into her bedroom and one of the servants is, you know, lying on the bed, rolling around, it's like, you know, she'd have him thrown out of the palace. It's just a no-no. But Govinda, of course, he explained what he was doing. So he says, no, what he was doing, he was actually he was making sure that the Lord's bed was not too hard. So he was testing it out. So he was neglecting a very important rule, which must be followed. Can't have everyone jumping on the Lord's bed. To follow a higher rule, because he was a greater lover than, he was actually more in love with the Lord than one who would just say to the Lord, you know, yeah, you just lay on that, and the Lord lays down as like a bag of bricks. Another example with Govinda is that one time he was, sometimes the Lord would, in the Gambir, I think it was, and sometimes the Lord would actually become unconscious in the doorway, and in his ecstasy, and so Govinda would just wait there, and he would not eat, for you know, even just fasting to the Lord, you know, come out of his ecstatic trance. But one time he actually stepped over the Lord. And again, you know, we don't step over anyone. It's considered offensive. But, you know, it was understood later that for himself, he was prepared to fast, but because he had to, I think he was preparing a meal or something for the Lord, so he had to step over the Lord in order to make sure that his meal or water and what have you was ready when he, you know, came out of his trance. So in that way he neglected a, you know, a very important rule and regulation in order to follow another one. So when Srila Prabhupada was here, devotees followed the main principles of devotional service, and because basically they were just doing what Prabhupada said, Krishna was happy. So if Prabhupada is, you know, giving that you just follow a codicil and no other information is given and the devotees follow it and even they break it at the wrong time, Krishna is perfectly satisfied because they're doing what their pure devotee says. If Srila Prabhupada mentions in his you know, lectures and books, which he does, that, you know, later on more information about these principles will be there for devotees to be able to follow them, which there is now, and devotees neglect that, knowing that Srila Prabhupada would have liked us to follow them, then we're causing an offence. Understand? Because the principle, the thing that pleases Krishna is our attachment to following the Guru, our attachment to following Prabhupada. If Krishna detects that someone is neglecting that part of the ekadasi rule and is due to a lack of attachment to following Prabhupada's order, then that is not good. So as you can see, sometimes something may be neglected and it doesn't matter, and other times it may be neglected, the same thing, and it does matter.
So one needs to know what Prabhupada said
before. No, the point is to be attached to Srila serving Prabhupada. That's the point. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So then the temple is wrong to tell people to go to, you know, don't get hooked on what time you're going to come.
Yeah, the temple authorities should always be encouraging people to do that which is most pleasing to Srila Prabhupada, whether it be following or neglecting. Sometimes following a particular rule is pleasing to Prabhupada, then do it. If neglecting that same rule is pleasing to Prabhupada, neglect it. The principal point is attachment. And it's a point there that, again, in the 14th chapter of the Nectar Devotion, or no, the 13th chapter, after summarising all the devotional principles and the five most important principles, that it's pointed out that, you know, one can make advancement by following one or all of the 64, or especially the five. One may take up one or all of them. And Prabhupada mentions, I think in a purport to the Chaitanya Charitamrita, where that same verse is there, that it's the teaching of Lord Chaitanya, it's the principle of attachment to devotional service which is giving the result. So one may follow one of those offenselessly and make all the perfection. They're completely attached to devotional service by following one. Others are very attached to devotional service and they follow all. But where they're both on the same platform according to their attachment to devotional service, not according to whether they're doing one or five. You see? In the same way, whether we neglect or accept the principle of attachment to Srila Prabhupada, pleasing him and Krishna is the principle. And that needs to be detected. So, you know, with further discussion with either the devotees following that, or the ones, you know, teaching the devotees, then that has to be ascertained. So, yep, any other questions? Yeah. What I'm going to do, just for a few moments. So we've got the essence of these two verses, that they're teaching us karma activities in the mood of service to the Lord, recognizing that he is the supreme proprietor, which, you know, lead towards liberation. Verse number 3, of course, is describing what happens when a person doesn't follow that, disregards that. As I was saying before, Srila Prabhupada's purports fill in all the gaps, because sometimes, you know, we may have a lack of an ability to see how, you know, even within, you know, a series of verses, how one connects to the other, how this particular, you know, Upanishad or Samhita or what have you fits in with other Vedic literatures. Srila Prabhupada's purports are very good in that they, you know, fill in the gaps and put us in the right context. So an important point here is that although the verse is actually pushing us towards acting, you know, in God consciousness just for the pleasure of the Lord, people can't actually jump towards that platform of life, and therefore Prabhupada mentions certain verses in the Bhagavad Gita, such as the third chapter, verses 9 to 16, describing how one works for the pleasure of the Lord, performing prescribed duties, karma yoga, and gradually by that karma yoga one comes to the point where he doesn't have to perform prescribed duties, because one becomes has no desire for any different things in the material world, and therefore one can actually perform akarma activities. So that's described there in the third chapter. And then verses here from the 18th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, verses 5 to 9, which are describing how one can, if one has, on the platform of karma, but one wants to do good in this material world. There are a lot of people who want to do good. They're altruists and philanthropists and what have you. And the Bhagavad Gita there describes how they can dovetail that, you know, in such a way that they become free from the reactions of their activities by doing those activities in such a way that it's pleasing to the Lord. So we can discuss that a little bit. What I'm going to do is I'll make you the team of altruists and philanthropists, so you can all take a particular role as someone who's doing some sort of welfare activity in this world. Alright, so what would you like to be?
Charity worker.
Charity worker, okay. Charity. Who are the recipients of your charity?
The homeless people.
Homeless people, okay. So? What's that? They're trying to help people. Yeah, so economic security for people, helping them, people get out of a poverty sort of stricken situation like that. Yeah. Yeah. Yourself?
Education.
Helping people to. Okay. Helping to make sure people have that access to education. For economic development. Eliminating bad elements, such as what, crime or?
Healthy.
Yeah, crime, so cleaning up the streets. Yeah.
Healthy.
Deep in thought there.
Yeah. I don't know, maybe a nationalist?
A nationalist, yeah, nationalist. Yeah, are they politicians? They don't help anyone. I better come back to you. You have a little bit.
Quite patriotic towards the country.
Oh, okay. That's what, so looking after the country, not a politician, but someone who's actually looking after the interest of their nation, like Gandhi or someone like that. So you can be.
Wanting to buy
Australia. Eh? Yeah. Okay. Making sure everything is green. Yeah. Yourself. Okay, so working for the clean up the water system within the What's that?
A leader?
Yeah. A leader of a gang of thieves? What's that?
A nation?
So, can politicians be counted as people who do good? Hey? Yeah, okay, we'll put you in as a politician. You sort of guiding the country towards their welfare, yeah? And yourself?
Healthcare.
What's that?
Healthcare.
Okay, making sure we have a proper hospital system and what have you. Okay, now. All right. Alright. So, I'm doubtful you're going to do anything good. I'm the devil's advocate. From what I see, the place is in a big mess despite all the work you're doing. So, can anyone assure me somehow that things are going to get better? From what I see, you're making a hell of a mess of the place. Can anyone give me some sort of confidence that things are, hey, as a result of your combined efforts?
If we didn't do it, then how much worse it would be.
I wonder whether if you didn't do it, how much better it would be. Think about it. Maybe you're part of the problem.
I can tell you that 10 years ago, this month, 1 million of the population could not even write.
Well, and 1 million of the population will.
And my organisation has reduced it by 50%.
So 1 million people. What was it? What would they? 1 million people
could not read or write.
Okay, so now we have more people that can read or write.
Yeah. They are not able to earn some kind of income. They can meet them with these kind of jobs, and they're able to support the families and even earn wage.
That's good. So I imagine we'll be doubling all the magazines and the newspaper stands, and I guess we'll be cutting down more forests to make way for all those new editions of the magazines and books and what have you from all these writers. So,
what
have
you got to offer, sir?
I'll get to that. First, I'm wondering what you guys are up to. So,
if there was no such organization as mine that could give food and shelter to people who are homeless,
that's
some of them cannot earn it.
Some people go hungry, it's a fact. So, by feeding people, they become strong, healthy, very active. So people who are working in perhaps the slaughterhouses, and people who are on the streets bashing people, so now because they're better fed I guess they can work harder, kill more cows, bash more people.
That's some of the people.
You don't discriminate. You just give food, whether they, you make them strong and healthy, no matter what they're going to do with that thing. So.
Some of them don't want to go work because they can access the food for free.
Yeah.
It sounds like you're on my side. So now because you're feeding them so well, they don't want to work. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah.
Well, that sort of helps me a bit.
Yeah.
That doesn't help your position very well. I'm sorry. That's actually a good point.
We can close down these non-government organizations.
Yeah, I think so.
My colleague is working for one of such, they collect the food that the restaurant doesn't sell, and then give it up in the evening to the homeless people. He said they are helping. Some of them really live in poor conditions. He said the question is how much you can really help. You can see the St. Kilda, I always see that when this van comes with the free food, and most of the people coming there are drunkards and drunkards.
I guess by because they've now got free food, they've got more money for booze. Yeah, that's good. He's shooting himself in the foot. All right, well, look, you're not giving me a lot of confidence so far. don't want to be too hard.
Well, I read a story in the newspaper the other day while I was from this person who was part of a very organisation that he says is working against society, where these people were, through the assistance of this feeding organisation, plus another organisation was able to provide some housing, I think, Jesuits, who were able to get a footing with some stability and move up the ladder, they were able to find work, stabilise the family, and then.
And they quite a few examples of that. So if we if people are happy and content, they've got education, they can get a good job, someone was providing employment, is that yourself? They got good water, good food. You're leading all this, right? Yeah. This is all going on under your jurisdiction, is that correct? You take responsibility for all of this? People are writing about, all the goods and bads of these things because they're now educated. So that means that they've got, more money to raise a family, get a nice television, buy all the new magazines on the thing. They've got more money for CDs and, listen to music, rock and roll, go to all the concerts. What's that? So it sounds like that they're pretty much, giving them a foothold into just full-on materialistic civilization where they're really comfortable. Before, when they were suffering, they might have had some thoughts that perhaps, question, why am I suffering? What is the purpose of life? Who am I? Is there a God? Now, of course, because they've got their televisions, their radios, their CDs, good food, they don't think like that anymore, and they're just completely absorbed in materialism. So you've done a good job, very good job.
Well, before they were not thinking about God. They were thinking about whether they get the next ejection prompt or whatever.
They
were living like animals, grimy, dirty, threatening, drugs, drunk, so on. Now we've made your life
safe. Okay. Well, the only difficulty I see there is that for all your good work, poverty is increasing. The lines of the hungry are increasing. The jobless numbers are increasing. Illiteracy is increasing. And illness is increasing. So it sounds pretty good, but actually the statistics... So I'm a little doubtful about the fact that how it would help, but... the statistics of what's happening means that more people are actually, for all the help that's being offered, it seems that more people are ending up suffering those conditions anyway. So either somehow the help is either ineffectual, because or the help is literally aggravating the problem, which is quite possible. Can someone refute that somehow? Yeah. What's that?
The death rate, the life expectancy
is decreasing.
As increasing.
Increasing.
For instance, in India, the life expectancy was quite poor 50 years back. There's so many diseases, and there was no cure for that.
Okay.
And it has increased at least by 20 years.
Oh, that's good.
Over the years.
So now people can spend more years in the poverty lines and more years of hunger and more years of suffering. So that's excellent. Very well done. Well done.
And same with the kids, the death of in the infant death used to be much higher. That has improved by a bit.
I can come in on your
side. Yeah, go on. Yeah.
If we look at the...
lay the boot in.
If you look at the success rates of those countries in the world, because all your efforts, your social welfare efforts, are towards the integration and economic development of marginalized groups of people. Right? If you look at those societies where they've got small populations of people like that, suicide rates are high, depression rates are high, mental health is no good. Well, what's the good of all your help?
Suicide is increasing at alarming rate in Australia, and as a fact, mostly the affluent countries. Yes.
And maybe what you need to be doing is that looking at, start by looking at those societies where human beings are mentally healthier, which is like India, like the Eastern society, etc., and see what it is that they are doing, which is good, which you need to integrate into your society to bring about even your better well-being.
But even devotees take help from our society. They come to our hospital, they utilize the hospital, so it's beneficial for everyone.
So, if you are actually employed like this, you'd be probably quite angry. How would you be feeling? You know, if you actually, if you spent your life and you really feel like you're doing some good, and then you confront someone like myself, how would you be feeling? Angry, or you think I was just a nonsense? Or do you think, you know?
Mm. We went through something like that, you know, a rejection of a particular social order, an introduction of what we thought was going to be the home for a new society.
Yeah.
And then it all falls flat.
It became worse.
Yeah, because when you answer completely, I chopped up everything. And
So there are a lot of people, that's a very good example, South Africa. There are a huge amount of people really just wanting to do good for everyone, for the country. Yeah. And the result of all their efforts is things are worse, basically. So, you know, relating to these verses here, so people are, you know, living in more darkness and ignorance, you know, despite education. Actually, people are more ignorant generation after generation. Even though they have technological skills and what have you, their, say, common sense, just, you know, steadiness of mind, you know, all of these things are decreasing. Their memory, their IQ, their ability to be creative with their mind and intelligence is, you know, decreasing to a certain degree. People are becoming very intelligently lazy because of television and what have you. Push button entertainment, push button and something thinks for you. Everything is done for you. So people are becoming more and more absorbed in activities and the modes of lower modes of ignorance, you know, passion, and of course because of those activities it's guaranteed that they will take birth, according to this verse, in lower and lower species of life, different parts of the universe, you know, animal species, or even, you know, very hellish different places. So despite the fact that there's so many people trying to do good, It appears that a lot more people are living their life not much different to animals, and sometimes not even with the sophistication of animals, and that they're actually therefore, you know, going to take birth. And, you know, that's another very serious point, of course, is that you know, if people become very well educated, how to eat, and, you know, they've got nice, good drinking water and good food, so they're basically, you know, they're eating plenty. they're being provided housing, someone is giving them housing, so sleeping, they're eating, they're sleeping, mating, you know, defending, like that. Really, all of that activity has just helped them to be, like, you know, polished animals, and their consciousness is very, very low. And their, you know, the net result is that, you know, a huge portion of the population of the earth, as a result of all the do-gooders, is actually going to take birth in very, very low species of life. Even if there's some increase, apparently, in their material facilities in this life, ultimately they, you know, yes, they've got a foot up here. you become a donkey, you know, he'll give you a foot up, you know, you become a, you know, a pig, you know, here, let me help you, you know, I'll give you help, you become a cockroach.
Especially because some other people are using up the system, like this assembling system that gives pensions for people who can't work for any reason. Then I personally know many people who are pretending that they have some kind of disability, they can't speak or integrate or whatever, and they're receiving, I don't know, $300 a week or something for a family, and that's just enough to satisfy their needs, and then what they do is they just go and work for one day a week to have some extra.
That's a fact.
Buy a nice cell phone, big LCD TV.
A lot of people are being encouraged to become lazy.
The person has the sensory help and has a plasma TV of this size.
I knew a fellow, it's a fact. I knew a fellow in New Zealand who, he travelled around the world, and what he did was he would sit on the street, he had a little sign, no home, no food, like that, and he would sit there. People would give him, you know, money. He would make hundreds. He travelled all around the world. He spent most of that, because I knew him quite well, he spent most of that on drugs, alcohol. He slept with, you know, other men's wives. You know, big meat eater. You know. He was a horrible person, and he used that money, you know, just completely in the most selfish ways. He travelled all the way around the world doing that, living, you know, have sex with someone, take off, you know, leave the family devastated. People, you know, giving charity, thinking, oh, I'm doing such a good thing. When I was in Bali, when I went to Bali, I took empty suitcases and I took over, you know, a lot of clothes and, you know, things like that. I actually gave them out. I bought new stuff and brought it back. But when I was over there, people would, you know, follow you down the street and ask you for money. And there was this one lady who came up to me and she sort of, you know, got a sari on. She got one breast out, feeding a baby like this, you know, and sort of looking like she's got, you know, really impoverished, and you feel really, really sort of, you know, you take one look at them, you think, oh, that poor thing, you know, I look like that. And anyway, I think I'd actually given her money, so I, you know, I didn't give her money again, but I saw her about 10 minutes later. She was round the alley with the guy and they were counting up. They had wads of money, huge piles of, like, you know, massive amounts, you know. It was just like this act that they just put on the streets. And it was really funny, you know, how Christian works. But another time, one of these ladies, similar to that, after I saw that, I thought, I'm not giving them anything. I just don't know who I'm giving to, you know. And, you know, I'll give someone to someone who I know who actually, you know, needs it. So I was walking up the street, and this lady kept following, give, 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 you know, like this, you know what I'm saying? And I just, you don't look, you don't say anything, you just keep walking, you don't make eye contact. I was walking, and I walked a long way. She followed me all the way up the street, you know. And then she finally stopped, and she turned away. And just, I took the next step, and I looked down, and there's this whole bunch of money on the ground. I picked it up, put it in my pocket. So it's like, you know, it was just this strange thing where, you know, Krishna wanted me to have that money. He didn't want her to have any, you know.
Yeah.
It was just, had she taken another couple of steps, I would have naturally let her pick it up because she was a beggar.
Yeah.
But she stopped. She just didn't take that extra couple of steps, turned around. So it was just a weird thing.
In many countries, the professional beggars in Croatia, I actually saw, I wouldn't believe my eyes, the very nice Mercedes van.
Yes.
Really beautiful, brand new. Stops in basically almost the center of the city, and then from that van comes about six or seven different, you know, disabled person, without legs, the other person is like a mother with small child, and I think three or four small children, you know, and then with the harmonium, you know, and then I know them. I knew them all from the street. And I couldn't believe. And then the guy, he's looking like he's really some kind of professional. Like you know, golden rings, and he's looking very nice. So he just stops, opens the door, and then all of them jump out. And then what he does, he's walking around and just checking if they are even begging.
Yeah.
That's his job. Okay.
You know, when I was doing Sankirtan, we used to travel through West Australia, and some towns there'd be, you know, they're all Aborigine, and you might get, you know, one or two, you know, the white people. And I remember one time I had my paintings. I looked at this town. Of course, you can never see where they are. There looks like there's no one there. But as soon if you stop. One person comes out of nowhere and says, "Oh, you got a cigarette?" You know? And you think, gee, you know, there's one person in this town. And the big mistake, of course, is if you give them some money or, you know, a cigarette, whatever like that. And then from out of nowhere, their cousin Charlie comes out. You know, "Oh, there's my cousin Charlie." "Really? Where did he come from?" "Oh, you got a cigarette for him?" "Well, you already got the pack in your hand, see, or you got your wallet out and all that." Okay. And lo and behold, there's, you know, his Auntie Josie, you know. "Oh, you got some cigarettes." So next thing, you're surrounded by about 50, you know, and your cigarettes are gone, and they're going through your rucksack, and, you know, "What you got in here?" And they just go through it. And they're all related like that. Anyway, I went to this one town, it's a fact. And this one guy, actually when I was in Broome, I was hitching out of town, one guy comes up to me and asks me for a couple of bucks to, you know, get a drink. And I said no, because they just drink it. They all, you know, that's what they were doing in those days. He had this little baby who was, you know, there was a woman with him, but the baby was probably about 1.5. Or it was sort of walking, just walking, completely naked. Mosquitoes just biting this baby. He said, "I'll give you this baby. You give me $2, I'll give you this baby." Just to get the drink, you know. But anyway, that was the sort of circumstances that, you know. So I went into one town, and they were all Aborigine. There was about a few shops, which is unusual. And I went into one shop. I couldn't work out what they were selling. There was sort of like some shells and things. There wasn't a lot there, you know. There was a couple of boots and a couple of old tins and things. And I thought, I'll try and sell them some paintings for their shop. So this, you know, one Aborigine comes out, and I thought, no way they're going to buy anything, but, I'll, you know, I'm here, we'll give them the opportunity. So I rolled out my paintings, showed them all. And I got, you know, half a dozen people were looking. And they go, "Yeah, I'll buy that one." And another one goes, yeah, "I'll buy that one." So these, you know, they're just like raggedy clothes and just look like, you know. They pulled out these wads of money coming from the government, you know, like, the average, they had huge amounts of money. They pulled out these wads. "Oh, yeah, I'll take this one. I made thousands." You know, because they in those days, that was, you know, government just pouring in millions of dollars, you know, and they just did nothing with it. They just drank. But, so in that sense, you know, here, of course, we've got to be very careful. I'm not trying to, nor is the Ishapanishad knocking altruistic work. In fact, Prabhupada quotes the verses from the Bhagavad Gita whereby one can do altruism. If one is doing that, the Vedas and Srila Prabhupada is not saying stop, but do it in God consciousness. Because only if you have a sense of God consciousness will you actually be able to do it properly. And that's the missing point. Right? As long as there's no God consciousness, all the so-called good that people are trying to do will not do one iota of good. And as soon as there's God consciousness, all that same work takes on, you know, immense value. Plus, those altruists gradually become free from karma, they please the Supreme Lord, and they approach liberation. So that's the point of that discussion there. All right, so we've gone a little bit over time. So next week we can, so, you know, read over those verses again and, you know, reflect on some of those things we discussed upon, and also read mantras 4 and 5. We're not here next Sunday. we will be here the following Thursday.